what they found was this unbelievable trove that showed what life was like, and that also served to memorialize people who were otherwise known only by their fate as Holocaust victims. When we think of Holocaust victims, right, we just think of, like, the most important thing about them is how they died. But what this arc did is bring people in their fullness back to life. And so in this archive, I looked at all these people, and that's what I'm always interested in as a writer. I just like people. I'm really interested in people. So I see all these people and their stories. And I said to my sister as we were leaving, like, there are 1,000 novels in that room. And she said, you should write one.
Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, a financial advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial Services.
And I'm Jess DeBair, Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and we can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission, our just cause, is to bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, I am so glad you asked me, because joining us today is accomplished author and professor Lauren Grodstein. She is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services Incorporated, and her views are her own.
Thanks for joining us, and let's see who's stopping by today.
All right, so Doug, we've had some pretty amazing guests so far on the Stopping By, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely.
And today's guest is no exception. I am so thrilled to chat with accomplished author Lauren Grodstein today. Lauren is the author of 6 novels, including the New York Times bestseller, A Friend of the Family.
Say that again.
The New York Times bestseller, A Friend of the Family. That's right, Doug. She's the big time.
This podcast, we're really classing it up. Listen, she brought the whole average up.
I know, we're the big time. The Washington Post Book of the Year, The Explanation of Everything, and her latest masterpiece, We Must Not Think of Ourselves, which is a beautiful story of love and determination and sacrifice, as it highlights an underground group of Jewish occupants of the Warsaw Ghetto who kept an archive to ensure their lives during World War II would not be lost to history. It is a heart-wrenching novel of love and defiance, and was inspired by the true stories of the code name Oneg Shabbat, a testimony gathering project at that time. It has been named a Best Book of 2023 by Kirkus Reviews, Best Fiction Books of the Year, and Best Historical Fiction of 2023, and was the Today Show Read with Jenna December 2023 pick. Come on.
Yeah.
Okay. Her work has been translated into French, Turkish, German, Hebrew, and other languages, and her essays and reviews have been widely published. She is a professor for the MFA program at Rutgers University Camden and lives in this beautiful state of New Jersey with her husband and amazing children. And perhaps most importantly, she's a very dear personal friend of mine. I cannot express enough how much I absolutely love this woman and her family. Our kids have grown up together. We've shared trips together. I love him so much. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lauren Grodstein.
Snap.
Snaps. Lauren, I love you. Thank you for being
here. Actually, there's a tidbit there too that I saw that I thought was pretty interesting. You got a shout out by SJP, Sarah Jessica Parker.
Yeah, we have.
Highlighted your book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So are you buddies now?
I would say we're not buddies. You know what I mean? And that we've never met, but we communicate through ideas. And it's just been the most wild month or 6 weeks I've had, years and years and years. So I found out about the Today Show pick, which is huge. You know, nobody knows how to sell books. Okay. And word of mouth is how books are sold. It's been proven again and again. Advertising doesn't really work, but word of mouth works. And I guess that Jenna Bush Hager has become everyone's book recommending friend. And so I knew that was going to happen in February. I was sworn to silence. As Jess knows, I am a sieve. I do not care. So I had to keep something quiet like that, really quiet for 8 or 9 months, like during the time I could have made it, like gestated a human baby. Like it was impossible.
Yeah.
But I somehow did it. And then the news broke. And then my life just kind of blew up for a couple of weeks. Still a little bit blowing up. Like the other day. Yeah. I mean, just people are in touch constantly. People want things, you know, small things, big things.
What do they want?
What do you mean by that?
What do they want?
Oh, gosh. I mean, a lot of
like people, a lock of your hair. What do they want?
I mean,
your dedication and your next novel.
They want attention. Like, I have found some people for no real reason other than they like the book. And so because I'm so grateful that people like the book and I'm so happy, I've just been trying to be in touch with this, you know, all sorts of people and being grateful because I am and thankful and excited, all of which I am. But despite the fact that I am a very sociable person, I also really like to be left alone for long stretches of time. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened at all this month. So that's, I think that's been
interesting. How did the Read with Jenna thing happen?
My assumption is that any publisher, any major or independent publisher worth their salt, is going to send books that they think might line up with her agenda of the major sort of celebrity book groups.
Right.
She tends to pick the most kind of ambitious or literary books. The way that my book got there is that my agent had an earlier book picked. And so she went to the set with a copy of my book before it was in a galley form, before it was just like spiral bound, like at Kinko's, and handed it, I think, directly to Jenna and said, please read this. And that was, and she gave me a picture of her like passing it on. I was like, that's as good as it's going to get, but that's pretty great.
Yeah.
I was at a conference in like a bookseller's conference in Seattle in February. And I was so jet lagged and it was a bookseller's conference. So my job was to schmooze with and charm booksellers. So I'd been on.
Right.
I finally got back to my hotel room. I set my timer for 45 minutes and I closed my eyes and I turned on Do Not Disturb. And then I opened my eyes and I missed like 30 calls. And my agent was like, were you asleep? I was like, I was not asleep. I was asleep. And she and my editor were on the phone. They're like, you know, Jenna picked your book. Don't tell anyone. And she does this big reveal on TV in front of, and she hands all these people outside copies of the book. And yeah.
So then you were on, you were invited on, you were on. So tell us about that.
Okay. So first of all, remember, this is all secret, but it's also the week of Thanksgiving that it happened the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. So my sister from Seattle and her family are in town and they were staying with us for a little bit. And I'm trying to secretly meet with producers while she's like in the kitchen and I'm like, I gotta go do a thing. And she's like, why are you wearing all that makeup? And I was like, am I? I don't know.
What are you talking about?
So I do all of the prep and there was a lot of it. They wanted photos, family photos, because they did throughout the month on Instagram, especially they shared some of my photos, some of my research from Poland where the novel is set. And then they asked if on December 4th, if I could be there. I said, yes, of course. They said, you can bring anyone you want. So my son, who's 15, come to New York and come backstage on the Today Show with me. And he was like, I mean, he checked to see what was up, if his friends were doing anything better. So he's like, yeah, that'll be cool. I was like, okay, cool. And so I sat down and I truly swear to God was not nervous at all. I was like,
you did not appear nervous. You were just like, it was like you were in my living room. It's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, because I have this weird superpower of just deciding not to be nervous.
So good. I was like proud mama moment. I was like, holy moly.
My mother, who was not very emotive.
Yeah.
Called. She's like, you finished and I burst into tears. I was like, oh, that's how I knew I was good. Cause my mom is very not. But,
when you get the mom to the brink of tears, you know something magical is happening.
Lauren, we don't have a lot of guests that have a Wikipedia page. So I enjoyed reading about your history and all this stuff. And I know you're from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. Jess is from New Jersey. And Jess and I were talking. So I know you went to Columbia and I know you got an MFA. So then you wound up in, so what I was thinking about was which came first? Did you want to go into academia and then you decided to start writing, or did you want to be a writer? And like, how do I support my writing passion?
That one. Yeah. I've always loved writing. I loved making things. I was a big liar as a child, but not like, not like a malicious one. I wasn't trying to get people in trouble. I was just trying to make the world like more interesting. So And then it turned out that there was like a socially okay way to channel that energy. And it was just in creative writing classes. So I'd always loved it. I was very lucky as a little kid. My parents were supportive. And then in high school, when there were actual creative writing classes, I took whatever I could get. And then I got to college, Columbia. I was from the New York area, but I was sort of naive in a lot of ways, and or just it just wasn't as cool. Columbia sort of attracted back then a lot of very cool kids, very smart, very wealthy, very chic kind of New York ready kids. Mm-hmm. I had been to New York a million times, but like to the Bronx where my grandma lived. Like I wasn't chic in any particular way. I came back and I had gotten into the Columbia MFA program. And even while I was at that program, I thought, well, I'm never actually going to be a novelist because that's a thing that normal people don't get to be, right? I'm going to be maybe I'll work in publishing or maybe I'll do pharma writing. I knew I could write, right? But like I also knew the world needed writers and I knew I needed a 401k and I knew, like, I just thought, well, I will always love to tell stories, but I will make my money elsewhere. But making money was a given. Like I had friends in my graduate program who were like, whatever, I'll figure it out. I was never a whatever, I'll figure it out person ever.
There wasn't anybody that imposed that on you. That was yourself realizing.
No, I mean, look, my dad, as Jess knows, you know, grew up in a one bedroom in the Bronx. He was part of that baby boomer generation that could like skip, so, you know, could kind of leapfrog social classes. And when I don't think people can really do that anymore. Mm-hmm. He grew up as the son of a dry cleaner. And now he's a kidney specialist in New York suburbs. I was not raised to like chase my passions. I was raised with a real sense of having been born into enormous luck and mm-hmm. given huge opportunities, and that I was going to at minimum pay my parents back for their investment by like not hitting them up for cash when I was 40. You know what I mean?
Don't screw it up.
So when I was in graduate school, I got to teach. I really loved it. I applied. I was very lucky. I started publishing soon after graduate school. I worked as a secretary while I was doing that. Yeah. And I would apply for tenure track jobs. I applied for, but they're like hen's teeth. They're just incredibly hard to come by. I had the choice between a 3-year gig at Fordham or a tenure track line at Rutgers Camden. I knew that the offer of a tenure track job mm-hmm. where I could teach writing in a place that was good to live. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like often if you do get one of these jobs, you find yourself somewhere, you know, remote or where you don't know anyone. This was a place that was an hour and a half from where I grew up.
Yeah.
So I knew I had to take it. And I did. Anyway, that is a very long answer to a very short question, which is that I always wanted to write. I love teaching. I love it. For me, teaching has always been to serve mm-hmm. even bigger love.
So can I, so teaching creative writing, mm-hmm. I think about this because I don't think I'm a creative person. How do you teach people to be creative?
Everyone has sort of uniqueness inside them. And that's all that creativity really is. My students come to me as graduate students. So they're already good writers. My job is to just help them get to wherever they want to be. So often that's like, they have a really good manuscript. It's just kind of not perfect. And I can help them get it there.
All right. This is a great place for this because I have a buddy who's a professor and he was at Drexel. He's been in a lot of great places. And early in his career, late at night, we'd be hanging out. And just to pick on him, we would read his reviews, his professor reviews out loud.
Oh, and like on, what is it, Rate My Professor, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yours are great. Like, so I'm going to read one of your reviews because I couldn't find a negative one. And this one is, listen to this.
Yeah, girl.
Rodstein. To say her name is to speak poetry. She's the best professor that the English department has hired in a very long time. Mm-hmm. And she's a great mentor and inspiration to aspiring writers. She gives great advice and only tells you her honest opinion, which only helps you grow as a student, writer, and person. I like her clothes. Take her in all caps.
All
you
caps can't find
take her. Just well when I
you cannot find a negative review.
I mean, I haven't looked at it. So, I mean, so who one thing about me.
Anything online is mostly negative. And
I don't look at reviews. I don't look at my book. I look at... Like, obviously, I looked at the New York Times. I'm not a monster. But, like, I don't look at Goodreads. I don't look at Amazon. I don't like to get reviewed.
Yeah.
I find it incredibly... That makes me nervous. Like, being on national TV does not make me nervous. Like, a 19-year-old kid says about me could crush me. Yeah. So, I...
One student said you were a hottie. I didn't read that one.
I have been teaching since I was 28, and we don't know how old that is. So
it's probably like a month old, Laura.
Probably like it probably just happened.
It probably did.
So academia, that's a neat thing. So and then now you're teaching. Now you're gonna write your first work.
I'm gonna write my third work.
When you first published your first ever work, how did you do that? How did you even go about that?
So the reason I said third is that I'd actually published two books before I got my job at Rutgers. And the reason I got my job at Rutgers is because I had published those two books and because I got lucky and because the woman, they were looking for a child who would do a lot of work for them and not think to say no. And that was me. So my first book was a collection of short stories. It was my graduate thesis. I published it with a tiny press. I gave a reading in a bar in New York. A publisher heard me. I mean, it was like Cindy, whatever, Claudia Schiffer getting discovered in a German mall, but also very different. And he put me in touch with a woman who was just starting out. She was a baby agent, or she's an agent's assistant. The publisher put me in touch with this baby agent. We just became really good friends because she had never sold any books and I didn't have any books to sell. And so there was no point in consummating this. But then finally, when I was done with graduate school, I said, I thought maybe I'd move to LA and try writing for TV, which was a really fun gig.
Yeah.
And I like TV. So I thought I could try that. And Julie, you know, who's just a really good friend of mine, she's like, I don't want you to leave New York. She's like, let me read what you've, I've never read anything of yours. Let me read it and see if I can sell it. And I was like, but you've never sold anything. She's like, well, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So she read my thesis and she ended up selling it to the publisher of this very small press who had put us in touch in the first place. And it was a lovely little book. They paid me $3,000 for it. I was so ecstatic.
Yeah.
And it got one review, one real review, but that review was in the New York Times. And it had an illustration in the book review.
Wow.
And that was fantastic. And that really set me up.
So let's talk about the book. I want to get into
Let's talk about it. First of all, so good.
Yeah, right.
It gets you in all the feels, like in your guts feels. So good. Tell us.
So in 2019, my sister took my parents, my brother's family, and my family, and her mother-in-law, which is 15 in total, to Poland, which is where a lot of our family is from. Get to Warsaw, where I had never been. I was not expecting much, really, but I found it just a haunting and amazing place. But what it does have, if you're Jewish, I think is a sense that like your generations of your people walk these streets, were buried under this earth. I felt that profoundly. And so by the end of our time in Warsaw, most of the folks, it had also been very, very heavy emotionally. So most people like went off to see the National Soccer Stadium, which was cool.
Yeah.
But my parents, my sister and I did not. Instead, we went to a place called the Jewish Historical Institute. I did not know what that was. You walk into this building at 35 Tlemasius Street, which used to be next to the Grand Synagogue. You can still see scorch marks. And written on the walls in Yiddish and Hebrew and English is what we were unable to shout out into the world. And you think, I don't know what that means, but okay. Hmm. And then you walk up the stairs and you see a big table, a huge table, and there are 32 names inscribed on the table. And it turns out that then you can pull out under each name a sort of a panel that tells you a little bit about who each person was. And it turns out that these 32 people comprised a group called the Oneg Shabbat Group. They were there under the charge of a guy named Emanuel Ringelblum, who was an historian. He tasked these 32, there might have been more, we don't know, but at least 32 people with writing down everything. And they did. They did like studies of starvation because the Nazis only allowed 247 calories a day, which obviously they wrote down schooling. They wrote down about the typhus epidemic. They wrote down everything. They collected documents and materials. There was like theater societies. They took the programs. There were cafes because social striations, right? They took down everything. And in 1942, something called the Gross Action started. And that was when 6,000 people a day were taken by train to Treblinka, where most of them were just killed upon arrival. They buried a lot of the documentation that they had collected at the beginning of the Gross Action. And then in 1943, in April, when almost everyone had either fled the ghetto or more frequently been deported to Treblinka, they buried the rest in these three huge milk cans. And in 1946, and then again in 1950, the three surviving members of the Oneg Shabbat Archive. So there were 32, three lived, a husband, wife, woman. They dug it up. What they found was this unbelievable trove that showed what life was like and that also served to memorialize people who were otherwise known only by their fate as Holocaust victims. When we think of Holocaust victims, right, we just think of like the most important thing about them is how they died. But what this arc did is bring people in their fullness back to life. So I see all these people and their stories. And I said to my sister as we were leaving, like, there are 1,000 novels in that room. And she said, you should write one. And I said, I don't think so, because I never, ever wanted to write a novel about the Holocaust. But then when the pandemic started, I just thought, well, I have to get out of my head with these people. I need to transport myself somewhere. And I've been thinking about this archive now for a year and reading about it. So I'll just try. This time is really hard for all the reasons that we know the pandemic was hard, but in a small way, just for me, I would never say this for other people. It was also a gift to not be expected to be anywhere or do anything. That's a lot of time, right? And what I like to do when I have time is right. So I just gave it a shot, and I didn't really talk about it, and I didn't know if it was any good. And that's not false modesty. It didn't matter to me if it was good. It mattered to me that I had done this thing during this difficult time. And I gave it to my agent, who's still the agent from all those years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's good. It's fine if it's not. I was still proud of myself no matter what. Yeah. I gave it to her. She said, this is really good. This is really good. We're going to sell this.
Did you find, like, more so than any before, like, you find yourself doing, like, I want to do historical research and make sure this is that as accurate as it can be? Like, you feel the pressure of, like,
absolutely.
I can't just write a story about, that it died.
Absolutely. In everything, in all these small ways, like, the protagonist had a cat before he went to the ghetto. Mm-hmm. And so I spent like at least an hour putting in the words cat food and then taking out the words cat food. Cause I had no idea if cat food was a thing.
Yeah.
And finally I just took it out cause I wasn't sure. Finally, at a reading, I met a 90-year-old man from Lithuania. His father had been a veterinarian. And I said, like, in the 1940s, right? So I said, was there cat food? And he said, no, you would just give your cat extra human food.
Yes.
That kind of thing. One thing I did, and nobody caught it, and I used the phrase transistor radio because I wasn't thinking, don't tell anyone. I'm not even sure I know what a transistor radio is. I just thought it was like those little radios. I was worried about cat food. Didn't even occur to me. I have had four men, no offense, Doug, it's only men, four separate write to me to tell me that a transistor radio, actually, what I meant was a crystal radio, and a transistor radio was not around in 1950s.
Anachronistic.
First of all, who knows what a crystal radio is? They would have thought you made that up.
Second of all, you took from my book, that's what you took.
I failed you.
Right? You don't have to share that with me. Like, that's okay.
I'd be like, you know what you can do with your crystal radio? Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what you can
take
do.
Your crystal radio and...
That's right. So this book, was the process for writing it, obviously, was different.
In some ways it was, and in some ways it really wasn't. In terms of research, I had a timeline of major World War II events taped right here on my desk so that I could always cross-reference like what was happening with what was happening in the ghetto with what was happening. One thing that I didn't really understand until I was writing this book, I mean, I guess I knew, but I didn't really think about what it meant, was that the U.S. did not get involved until almost the deportation started. They got involved in late 1941. The ghetto was established in November 1940. Mm. The people of the ghetto had been waiting for the Americans to show up and save them from the moment that Germany invaded, really. And it never happened. And not only did it never happen, they didn't even start getting involved at all until so many people had died. Like, the American World War II experience is so different, I guess, from... So that was something that I thought about a lot. I read a ton of history books, which is not my usual. I always read a lot when I'm writing because I want to get things right.
So you said you started this during the pandemic and you're reading all these, and not to make light of this, but I mean, this is a really heavy topic. How the heck, and you're going through in the middle of the pandemic, which is also a very heavy time for their country. How the heck do you stay like light, a pleasant person to be around? Or was it? Well, we were going to bring your husband in right now.
I do not find this kind of work. It is sad, but it doesn't depress me. Mm. I find it incredibly invigorating to dive into another time period. It is heartbreaking, obviously. And it is individual stories are, I don't have the right words for how horrifying so many of these stories are, but I wasn't looking at their deaths. Even though I always understood what was happening, but like I would read the archive read stories in the archive and just look at people's lives. Mm-hmm. And I find that just fascinating. So that never depressed me. Like, I could spend hours in the archive and not feel sad at all, because what I was reading about were like kids in school, mm-hmm. you know, or like yeah. ways people figured out how to cook new things.
Tell us about the characters in the book.
The main character is a guy named Adam. Adam was a language teacher before the war.
Right.
He was not a very observant Jew, and he was married to a Catholic before the war. That was important, because if he had been an observant Jew, he probably would not have made it. Observant Jews had very few resources outside the Jewish world, and the Jewish world was all in the ghetto. So I made this character an observant Jew who didn't know any Catholic people, his story would have been like, and I went to the ghetto and then I died. It often happened. You needed, in order to survive, not always, but most of the time, you needed connections outside. And he had some because of his previous life. You know, and he's a really gentle guy. And we shared a lot of interests. Like, he likes books and poetry, and so do I. And he likes languages, and so do I. And he likes just sort of being left alone. He likes teaching, so do I. And so I really liked writing him. But my favorite people to write. So the way the book works is that he is tasked in the very beginning. He's an imaginary member of this Oneg Shabbat archive. And in the very first scene, he is tasked with interviewing students and or people that he lives with or anyone. And so throughout the book, he interviews students. And that was my favorite part. Mm-hmm. Like, writing these kids was great. Yeah. Imagine their lives, bringing my own kids into them. You know, the kids often managed to just, I don't know, just adapt in ways that I guess not, because I think people are always so resilient. Like, horrible things happen to kids and it lasts forever. That lingers in them forever. But like, because they just didn't know how much they were losing, I think they were able to just sort of take this for what it was. And kids had a lot of freedom in some ways. Kids were smuggling. Kids didn't have to go to school all the time the same way they used to. So it was a little bit different. And trying to imagine their lives was my favorite part. The other thing that helped write this book, I'm thinking again about sort of what wasn't depressing about it, is that I got to put myself back in a place where I didn't know what the ending was a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I was living in a pre-Holocaust time or a pre-death camp. I mean, it was all the Holocaust. It was pre-death camp time. The idea for the death camp started at something called the Wannsee Conference, which wasn't, you know, for another sort of 2 years into the war. Yeah. So it wasn't like World War II starts and then Auschwitz is set up. But that all took time.
Right.
And a lot of the book takes place before the Wannsee Conference. And so I got to live in a time before the death camps. And that's just a better world to live in, mm-hmm. no matter what, even if you're in a ghetto like this, and even if people are starving, like, a world in which Auschwitz does not yet exist is a better world. And so I got to be in that world. They had no idea, because it shouldn't be possible. That should not be possible. But it is. And we know that it happened. And these people still got to live in a world where it hadn't. So.
Your New York Times review actually said, it's kind of like, as you set the stage of what's happening slowly, it's like boiling the frog. The frog doesn't know it's being boiled because it's all happening almost subtly. It's a good kind of reminder to pay attention.
Oh my gosh.
Follow the news.
I mean, that's what's so freaky about this moment, right? Like, I found myself, and this has nothing to do with the war in the Middle East, which is not a thing I am any more equipped to talk about than anybody else is. But I think we are all equipped to talk about anti-Semitism that we see around us. And for the first time in my life, soon after October 7th, before Israel started pursuing its war in Gaza, before there was any reason to start screaming about Israel necessarily, my sister's synagogue was vandalized. When all that started happening, I was like, oh no. You know, I started thinking about how my son looks kind of Jewish, but his hair is blonde, his eyes are blue, so maybe that's okay. And my daughter doesn't look Jewish at all, so that's good. And then I couldn't believe I was thinking that. I was really thinking, like, they will be safe. Like, I look, you know, like an Israeli flag, but they look a little less so. And I felt, like, weirdly grateful for that. And that is a screwed up thing to
think. Scary. That's crazy, yeah. So I want to pivot here for a couple of minutes, since we do have you, Lauren, and you're such an amazing resource. Talk to our people, our vast pool of listeners, about people who maybe want to get published, or they love to write, but they don't know if they're any good, or they don't know what they should do. Can you talk a little bit about that and any tips you might have for them?
Really, yes, that is a good thing. That is a good thing to talk about, because lots of people want to write, and lots of people feel embarrassed that they want to write, which I think is silly. You can write at any age. It's not like ballet or, right? Like, you cannot be, if I was like, you know what, Jess, I'm going to be a ballerina, you can't stop me. Be like,
I would say I will buy your tutu and I will tie your shoes.
Thank you.
I'll jam your feet into those wine.
Right.
Less wine, less cheese.
Yeah. First things first, we got to break your toes. Being a ballerina, hard. Being a published writer, very hard. But just writing itself, not so hard. You just have to take the time to do it. That's like the most important thing. Just make it. If you feel weird, like because you haven't brushed your teeth, try to feel equally weird if you haven't written a couple sentences every day. So that's the first thing. It's just like value yourself and your own interests and your own dreams enough to just do that. Then many, many communities, community colleges, bookstores, writers, you know, houses, and like Philly has a bunch of them, have writing classes, writing workshops, right? Just sign up for one. Like I promise you, no matter how embarrassed you are, someone out there who's not as good as you is not embarrassed at all. And then if you think that you're at a place where you have a manuscript that you'd like to go out into the world, there are all sorts of ways to do that. But one thing that I think is really can be helpful is if you just reach out to some writers. Like there are books and all sorts of ways that, you know, people can sort of figure out how to get published. But like I have found in my life that the people who have helped me the most are the people who have already done it. But if you have some writers in your life who just their books mean something to you, writing and saying so and asking for a word or two of advice is never a bad thing.
Right. Who doesn't want to hear, advice. I love your work?
Exactly.
So I have a question. Stein worked as a patent examiner, right? That was, he made some money and that's how he could pursue the things he loved, right? You were in academics, had made enough so that you could pursue the thing you love. Tell me, what does money mean to you?
I would say it means security. And I think that is where this history really intersects with mine. I think that money and feelings about money get passed down like any other, like the way you think about money and the way that you deal with money. I grew up in generations of people who had lost everything. I think that making a little bit of money for me always means that it means that it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. It does not mean like now you can follow your dreams. It just means that like they probably can't chase you out of your house, which sounds really dire. It sounds really dire, but is just, I think, the natural result, not just for me, but for so many second, third generation Americans who come from people who did not have security. But where my spending is off the charts is just travel. Yeah. And it is always for research. Therefore, I'm always terrified that the IRS is going to come at me because like who goes to this many places? But I do. So,
you do. And also, you're a master at it.
I don't make enough for anyone to care about. That's the thing. The accountant always told me, like, really, honestly, nobody cares. Calm down. Like when you open a Toyota dealership, that's when we'll talk. Otherwise.
What's coming up next? What's coming down the pike?
So the next couple months are a lot of touring and traveling and book clubs and traveling and talking and book clubs and that. And I'm working on something new, which I really like. It's about a woman who sort of like finds herself. It's very different from this book. And it's just like a woman who finds herself in Eastern Europe dealing with stray dogs, which doesn't sound like it makes any sense, but it hopefully will. And then, you know, so I'm working on that. And I'm, you know, I mean, I do a lot of the stuff that like we all do. I'm a chauffeur.
Oh yeah. Listen, when they get their license and you're not a chauffeur anymore, it's a whole new world.
Is it better? It's better, right?
It is. It's terrifying.
Yeah, because I'm scared of that part.
It's definitely terrifying, but it frees you up. So a little bit of both. Yeah. Well, listen, girl, I love you so much. And to our listeners out there, I strongly encourage you to go out and grab Lauren Grodstein's We Must Not Think of Ourselves. Add this book to your Amazon cart. Go to your local bookstore or wherever you get your books, Target, whatever. You will absolutely love this book as much as I did.
Thank you for doing this for us.
Yeah.
This is very good. You're going to raise our status to the level of the Today Show. My wife, we have a newborn. She's watching the Today Show a lot more. And I'm like, honey, you know this? Oh, yeah, I know about Jenna. I'm like, oh dang, let's go now. Hey, Lauren, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for stopping by.
I stopped by. Bye.
Bye, girlfriend. Love you.
Love you too. Bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.